When the world ended, you lost everything. You survived because you had each other. Now, one of you has been infected. In your final days together, what will you say? Hey, it's Elliot from the My First Dungeon team, and I'm excited to tell you about my next game, The Time We Have, A Conversation Between Brothers, a tragic zombie storytelling game headed to BackerKit on October 29th. This game is played on opposite sides of a closed door with a custom deck of cards that will guide you through a story about what it means to be a brother in the final days before one of you turns. To make this game a reality, we need your help to give us the best possible launch on day one. So please head to bit.ly/thetimewehave and pre-save the campaign so you can be notified as soon as we launch. That's bit.ly/thetimewehave. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Johan Noor, a visual artist and graphic designer known for his works on such projects as Morkborg, Cyborg, Rascal, and the upcoming Paint the Town Red. Johan, welcome to the table.
Welcome.
Hey. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have
you. Great to have you. We've been really looking forward to talking to you about all the stuff that you've done, because you've done so much cool stuff.
I've been very productive. Yeah, it's been wild, actually. it's fun.
So, Johan, we always at the top of this show like to kind of set our goal for the conversation, what we want to get after. And so today we really want to talk to you about the strong visual identities that you're known for creating in TTRPGs, games like Cyborg, Morkborg, the upcoming Paint the Town Red from our friends at Soul Muppet. And of course, perhaps what you're best known for is Morkborg. And so our first kind of question is that we both feel that Morkborg is a game that you just have to pick up and flip through when you see it on a table or a gaming store shelf or at your friend's house in their collection. So in as simple way as we can ask, how'd you do that?
Yeah, how'd you do that?
I don't know.
Hey, tell us, how'd you do that?
What was the secret? I guess, I come from like a traditional graphic design background. Like I've been schooled traditionally. So I think I've sort of learned the like ins and outs of how you make something, I don't know, pop or like to make a visual identity of a product or a concept or whatever. So I guess what we wanted to do with Morkborg was to do something that was really loud, like not literally loud, but visually loud. And because it's so tied to like the whole musical genre of extreme metal and that sort of very loud and violent sound, we wanted the visuals to also represent that. And I don't know, just have like, I realized that my bookshelf didn't have many yellow books in it. So I saw that as sort of a opening for us to do something with. And it sort of turned out that we now kind of own the color yellow, which wasn't really, intentional. Well, in a way it kind of was, but we didn't really intend it to be at this scale. But I think, yeah, color is a powerful tool for any graphic designer, obviously. So
yeah, I don't think anyone goes into a publishing endeavor and thinks that they're going to corner the market on a color.
But you guys really not a primary, at least. You know?
Yeah, certainly not a primary.
I mean, it says something about the tabletop industry, I guess, that no other game had really done that at that level, or like that many games. So yeah, it was an opening there.
I love that you brought up that you are kind of like classically trained as a graphic designer and have sort of this experience of the rules, because there was a recent Twitter thread from Clayton Notestein that broke down sort of the design principles within Morkborg and how your eyes moves across the page. And you responded with this line that I'll quote you back to you. "This article made me realize that I actually failed my design goal of Morkborg. I wanted to see what would happen if I broke all the rules I've learned studying and working in graphic design. I didn't break them. I just followed them in odd, extreme ways." So I want to talk about this. Like, what were some of those rules? How did you follow them? How did you try to break them, but inevitably end up following them?
I think my intention was, because we've talked about doing this as sort of a punk scene look. I mean, it was originally meant to be just a staple scene and not a book, but I wanted to see how many rules I could break without it becoming sort of useless, like because I've been working with so many like classic projects, like I've been working in not advertising specifically, but more like marketing and stuff. And you don't really have that room for experimentation that much there. So I wanted to take the opportunity now and do whatever I wanted and just see what would happen if I throw all these rules out the window. And I think what I did was sort of not have any templates, sort of reinvent the design on every spread, use as many typefaces as I could, because that's a rule, like you should only have 2-3 typefaces. And I decided I'm going to do 100 typefaces and use like Comic Sans and Papyrus and those like unloved, forbidden typefaces that I think desperately need some redemption, because I'm a fan of that. But I feel like regarding that thread, that I realized when Clayton did that article that I sort of the underlying structure in a way and the basic sort of presentation and the visual hierarchies, I still followed those rules, quote unquote, because I couldn't do anything that I felt was like unusable. Like I still had a purpose and a design goal in a way with the book. And maybe I subconsciously just follow the rules that I've been taught. So I have to try harder next time, I guess. But
I feel like it's like that thing in your brain where I know I get this way as like an artist, like you look at something and until it looks right, you won't stop like fiddling with it, even if you're making something kind of out there.
It still has your name on it, right? So you still want to leave something good behind, even though you're experimenting and like want to push it.
I do want to see the Morkborg where someone just says, like, this is unusable. Don't read it.
Oh, we've had those comments a lot. I can tell you that. So, yeah. It's a very, like, either you love it or hate it type thing. So we've had a lot of these comments, like, oh, it's unusable and it's, you know, unplayable and everything. And that's fine. You can think that if you want. Like, I disagree, but I will respect you thinking that. So
it is really interesting, though, that despite trying so hard to break these rules, that there are just some confines that are almost innate to design, that you're like, I want to push past as many of these as possible, but here's the actual wall that I can't push past if I want this to be the thing I want it to be.
Yeah. And I think that it's probably like my experience as well, because I've been doing this for so long. So I sort of know what I want to do and how I think a product will like work. Because when I think of books, I think in terms of spreads and in terms of not just singular spreads, but also the spreads like in sequence. So like when you flip through it, what happens with the experience of browsing through the book? Because I said that before, I'm not sure who said that, but it's like a very slow animated movie, a book, when you flip through it. Like every spread is a frame, and in a way, it's sort of something happens when you flip through it. There's a movement and there's a momentum, and that I think you have to consider when designing. So like every spread, something new should happen design-wise, but not too drastically. There should still be a thread that ties them together in a way.
I think every spread a frame is your inevitable design instructional book.
Yeah, that's a good name.
Every spread a frame, that's good.
No, I think that. And it you know, doesn't matter what book I make, I think that way. And about the experience of not necessarily reading it, but just flipping through it, because that's what I do mostly with books. And it's just like when if you look at Into the Other Cyborg or like any book that I've designed, I hope that comes across so that the reading is not, it doesn't have to be pleasant, but it has to like do something with you.
Yeah. And we'll get into this a bit more later, but I'm immediately thinking of the Paint the Town Red Blood Gutters that Soul Muppet recently previewed, like, and in GIF format where you're seeing all the spreads of those blood gutters slowly crawling out. It very much gives that effect of like an animated seeping of blood. So
that's actually a very good point. Yeah, that's a very literal sort of presentation of that, because the idea with those blood gutters is that it represents like your inner hunger or like your desire to feed on blood as a vampire, and you have that within you and you try to control it as much as you can. And this blood gutter at the literal heart of the book, right, is controlled and it's under control for the most time. But then as you sort of reach the end of the chapter and the beginning of the next one, it starts to tremble and it starts to overflow. And then eventually at the start of the next chapter, it just explodes in a cascade of blood. And that's you becoming sort of not feral, but like you become this vampire monster. And then it goes back into control again. So it's really a dance. It's really an animated movie. Yeah, it's in book form.
We've been talking a bit about like the rules and trying to break them and what rules kind of like are inherently there that we can't get past. I'm curious what, in your mind, when you're looking at design, when you're looking at either something that you're making or someone else is making, what do you consider to be good design and great design? Like, what elevates it from being good to great, by whatever metric you may choose?
Okay, so I think good design is, well, pleasant on the eye. It's well balanced. It's good typography. It's like the details are there and there's a good general concept. Like that's good design, and I appreciate that. Great design is something where there's a clear concept and a clear goal, and you strive to have the design fulfill that goal, even though it doesn't have to be nice looking. It doesn't have to be, you know, beautiful, but it has to like go through with the concept, and it has to communicate the concept and maybe elevate graphic design from just being a container for content and into being something new and something bigger. That's what I feel is great design. I can't think from the top of my head of any like examples of that, but when I experience that and when I see that, that's when I really go, oh damn, I wish I had done that. And I wish, you know, that's what design is all about, in my opinion.
I feel like we talk about like the intention of a project a lot on this show, of like how much you can feel when someone comes into something with a clear intention and like, and then delivers on that intention. I feel like when it comes to where you're sitting in creating a visual identity, I imagine you are balancing multiple facets of that intention, one being like authorial intent, one being the game's themes, one being the mechanics. How are you sort of thinking about these different aspects of the intent of a game when making a visual identity, maybe using Morkborg as an example or something else?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah, there is definitely a lot of things you have to keep in mind, and there's a lot of goals. And you as a designer also have your own goals in a way. Like you add your own things that you want to achieve. But so Morkborg, for example, well, one of the goals was to visualize the end of the world and the shattering of reality, because like not only the geography is ending in the world, but the universe itself and the laws of physics and everything, it just ends. So we wanted to show that visually with how chaotic it seems and everything, you know, everything is breaking down. But also we wanted to sort of challenge the whole industry in a way, in how you can make books. So that was another design goal. So just that's why we had so many weird effects like foil on the inside. And we had all these sort of stupid things, really. But that was just to sort of shout and scream, hey, look, you can do books this way as well. Like, you can do this. Maybe you shouldn't, but you can. Like, that's... And then I think for, like, different parts of the book have different goals as well. So the first part is all about getting you inspired into this chaotic world and the end of the world, that sort of thing. And then when it comes to the adventure, that's all about running at the table and usability at the table, accessibility 100% and all that stuff. So they're two very different... It's like two books in one, in a way. And then how the end papers, like... the goal there was that they should act sort of like a GM screen, so they have all the rules and all the references you need when playing. Like you shouldn't ever have to touch the book really when you play. So your focus should be on the game, not the book.
Staying on the point of something like Morkborg, of how you guys did so much within that book, of including like, you know, gold accents and or foil accents, all these other things. At a certain point, that does become a like cost equation. Like each of those things can get expensive. As a designer, do you just go in and throw everything at the wall and then like we can always take away?
Unless I have a specific budget, yes, pretty much.
Perfect.
We had the luxury of not doing this as our full-time job at the time. Now it's my full-time job, so I think a bit differently now about it. But we both had jobs and this was a hobby project that we did on the side. So our goal was never to do more than break even, actually. So we just asked the printer house, like, what can you do? And we want to do everything. So as long as we get the money back, we're fine. So it's a very expensive book to print. And in the beginning, we didn't make a lot of money on each copy sold. But that's, yeah, I mean, unless we have... Sometimes you have a set budget. I always try to, like, add as much stuff as possible. But then... You know, you have to be realistic as well, especially when you hope to like buy groceries and pay taxes with the money you make from the games. That's a whole different reality. So,
damn taxes.
Yeah, come I know on. It sucks. But yeah, you have to do it. You have to do it.
Kind of continuing the conversation of good and great design. I'm curious, in your opinion of your own work, what do you think is your greatest success design-wise? By what, I mean, not necessarily monetarily, but like by whatever metric you choose, what do you think is the most successful?
I mean, McBoy has to be up there, right? That changed my life when I did that book. But it's also, for me, kind of the obvious answer, because that's what I'm most known for. But I think, I don't know, I really like Into the Odd as well, like that whole package, because it's so different from what I'm known for. And I'm very happy with how it turned out. It became a very elegant book, and I think it proved to the people who were worried that my name was attached to the project that I can actually make like nice books as well, not just monsters and demons and stuff and, you know, splattered ink. So that's one of my favorite products that I've made, the physical products. Very happy with that.
And like, I feel we talked about like rules, and obviously with Morkborg and kind of now like your body of work beyond Morkborg, Morkborg, Cyborg, etc., you've sort of created your own version of rules. And obviously Morkborg has a huge third party community around it. How successful, like in your measure, have like people been in following these new rules you've created? Or like, do you feel like you've created sort of rules that people follow when they make third-party content? I'm like compelled to think of like Pirate Borg, which was a game I picked up last year, and how that like very much follows the identity path of Morkborg, but while bringing its own thing into it. Like, how has that been, seeing people follow these rules you've created?
I actually like more, I mean, I love Pirate Borg, and I love Luke and all the, you know, everyone behind all those bigger projects, but I actually more, my favorite Morkborg hacks and third-party things are the ones to totally make their own thing and, you know, don't care about what we have done. And don't necessarily try to emulate Morkborg, because we never wanted to make our own. I mean, it's like we're, you know, punks who grew up and, you know, got real jobs. Like, we wanted to break all the rules, and now we have our own rules that we make, and we're trying to break free from those. So...
yeah, here are the 10 steps on how to be punk.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, like, this was... the intention was never to, like, write our own rule set for design. Like, that was the absolute opposite. But it sort of happened anyway. I mean, you can see some of the books that they follow the pattern, and, like, how our book is presented with the end papers and the setting and the rules and everything. Like, how you write that. And, I mean, I take that as a huge compliment, of course, because that means it maybe worked, but I'm most inspired by the projects that just make their own thing and, you know, that aren't called something Borg and aren't yellow or pink or, you know, that turns what we have done upside down. So that's fun. And I also challenge myself when doing new stuff. So, like, for example, when we're doing Tephrotic Nightmares now, that's intentionally like an anti-Morkborg visually. Like, it's just grayscale, there's no color, because that was what we had in the core book, and it's not as chaotic. Like, I try to identify what sort of rules and guidelines I set up for myself and move away from those, because the same goes with Pelle as well and the writing. Like, we don't want to create our own boundaries for ourselves and, you know, be within those. But we don't want to trap ourselves.
I don't want to, become the one trick pony.
Yeah, because that was so inspiring for us to do that in the first place. And so, like, yeah, we don't want to fall into a hole.
There's a good question there, because I think because of the success of Morkborg, you are generally associated with a very particular style. And obviously, you do a lot of other stuff, but, like, you've been put into a bit of a box by some people. Do you find that having such a noteworthy style, for one thing, is that helpful for you as a designer, or is that more something you've got to like buck up against more often than not?
No, I think it's helpful, because there's a good understanding of my sort of baseline or where we begin, and then we can move from there. So I think it's definitely been helping. I mean, there's been times where I've looked at my work and I've been like, damn, I can't do anything else than this. Like, am I really the guy that only draws, you know, skeletons with horns? But then, and also, like, and then I realized, no, I can do other things. And then also, so what if I am? Like, isn't that fine? Can I, you know, I think artists should just accept that, you know, they have a certain style and they have a certain motif of something that they enjoy making and, you know, fucking go with it. But Yeah, I want to challenge myself and do other things as well. And those are the best commissions, in my opinion, as well, that try something different and, you know, asks me to go beyond my comfort zone and explore other styles. Even though they might be similar in a way to what I do, but as long as they introduce something new, that's inspiring as hell to me.
What is the kind of commission that you would love to jump on as like a totally outside of your comfort zone challenge? Like, is there a kind of job you would want to do?
Oh, it would be fun to have someone reference like a style that is completely different to mine. I see no reason why they would do that, but it would be challenging and fun to be like, hey, can you do this sort of painterly style? I don't know, or this sort of medieval wood carvings or cuttings. Maybe that is similar to what I do, but Art Deco, like, you know, something completely different. Because I worked like as an art director for a long time with different like clients of all different businesses and different styles. Like I'm sort of used to doing that, to dip into a visual world that I'm unfamiliar with and force myself to sort of learn and or love that style. I was actually doing a project a long time ago, only in Swedish, a role-playing game called Oktoberlandet by the same guy who made White Hack, actually. And it was this sort of pseudo-Russian steampunk folk fantasy thing. And the style was this constructivist, like Bauhaus, you know, I think it's called like futurist style. So these very striking like angular shapes, and it was all, you know, red, black and white and everything. And I didn't really like that style at first, but then as I researched it more, I came to like it a lot and actually love it now. So, and that's also one of the books that I'm very happy with having done. So, and I wish it would ever get an English translation, but I doubt it. But it's a nice artifact at least. But that sort of thing, to like jump into a different style that I'm unfamiliar with and just learn the ropes.
So to designers listening, hit Johan with a pitch for a totally out there, away from his usual stuff.
Come on, yeah.
Which I think like kind of connects to me. Like, I think you now said that like this is now your full-time job. So someone approaches you with a collaboration, like, hey, I want to work, like, I want like to have the Johan Noor visual stamp on this game. What is an easy yes for you when someone comes to you with a project, other than money?
Far too many things. I mean, money isn't really the thing that drives me. It's these weird pitches that I get, and I'm terrible at saying no. So to my own and my calendar's dismay. But I don't know. If someone hits me up with a weird pitch, and I'm usually in, like, if I can fit it, I will do it. And it's usually, I mean, sometimes there's big projects, but there's usually like smaller, one illustration or new cover for this. And so super fun.
So designers out there listening, just make sure Johan doesn't care about money. He just wants something weird.
Easy yes.
Distinctly yeah. Not in his styles. That's all you need to know.
Exactly. What have I done?
We'll put your email right in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, no. In an ideal world, then I will probably. I've just started this on a full time now, so maybe I'll regret this sorely.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. It's been since October, so it's like half a year, but I'm keeping busy at least.
Rom-com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom. Or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Don't look under the bed. Don't open the closet. And whatever you do, don't skip this ad.
World Champ Game Co. is the one-stop shop for all of your horror desires this Halloween season. Sink your teeth into classic thrills with Slasher Card Game 1978, The Night They Came Home. Keep close to the light as you weave eerie new tales with Campfire, anthology horror storytelling. Whatever makes your spine crawl, World Champ has a game for you. Run for your life to worldchamp.io and grab your next favorite horror role-playing game. And right now, get 20% off your order with code KILLER. Again, that's 20% off at worldchamp.io with code KILLER. And when you can't fall asleep at night, just keep telling yourself, it's only a game.
The Between is now crowdfunding on BackerKit. The Between is a new role-playing game from the creators of the award-winning Brindlewood Bay. Inspired by Penny Dreadful and Sherlock Holmes, you play as monster hunters in Victoria-era London, investigating and neutralizing these supernatural threats that terrorize the city. Threats that Scotland Yard can't or won't handle themselves. As the story progresses, you become aware of a criminal mastermind pulling the strings behind the scenes. In the end, you will have to face this mastermind in order to save both Queen and country. Rewards for backing this project include The Between's core rulebook, Shadow Society, an expansion book for the game's London setting, and Sons of Another World, which gives you three brand new settings for The Between. And back early to get access to a limited reward, the glow-in-the-dark Mastermind Dice. So head right now to BackerKit and search The Between.
I mean, you talked about, like, you say yes to a lot of things, but I feel like you just also have an output as an artist. Like, you create just a lot of work, and, like, that became really apparent when I picked up your art book, which I have over on my shelf here. And, like, flipping through that book, it's just apparent that, like, you are someone who makes art all the time, you know? And I think that the section that I really loved was the section where you were forcing yourself to make an illustration every day. And then, like, some of those ended up getting, like, licensed to, you know, feature in people's books or, like, popped into a game that you were working on. I guess the question I have for you is, like, for folks out there who are, like, artists, like, how do you stay sustainable? How do you keep that, like, love for creation for yourself? Like, how do you make it so that you're, like, sustainable while having the kind of output you have?
I think trying to lower your own expectations and threshold is key. That's been my biggest problem, because I mean everyone is a perfectionist, and you want to always make the best thing ever. You just have to accept that you will not, like, reinvent the wheel every time. I think about that as sometimes, because we had such sudden success with Mörkborg, I sort of look at myself and I go, okay, this next thing that I do, it has to be as, you know, game-changing as Mörkborg. It has to fucking reinvent the industry. Like, oh, it has to be. And that's impossible. You can't think like that. You're just going to kill yourself, you know, with that. So I don't know. That's why I did these sort of forced artworks. So just, I have to sit down and draw something. Doesn't matter if I have any inspiration. Doesn't matter if I don't have any energy. Just do it. Just draw whatever and post it online. Like, remove that sort of, don't throw it away. Post it and act like, I mean, you can say, oh, this is just a sketch and I hate it, but just post it, because that will hopefully will remove some of the stress from that. At least for me it did. But, and I don't know. Just try to accept that not everything has to be great all the time. It's what's the quote? Done is better than perfect, or something.
Perfect is the enemy of great. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. I totally subscribe to that. I think that's a terrific quote.
That is especially with the amount of, like, podcasts and layout stuff that we've been doing. It's like, yeah, it's done when it's due. The deadline is the ultimate decider of the thing.
And make your own deadlines. Like, if you don't have a deadline, just call it finished and send it off and do your next thing. You can't sit there and polish it, you know, 100 years. It's because just release it.
Kind of on that topic, for you, when you're working on a project, what gets you stuck? Like, is there anything that consistently comes up where you're like, I'm having trouble with this, and this is the thing I need to work on and grow with?
Yeah, I think usually it's, okay, there's two things. I think first it's to find the concept and the direction and to figure out, because that's problem solving. Like, you have a problem, or the person you're working with has a problem, and your job is to solve it somehow in an interesting and good way that works, you know, with the identity of the thing and your own, you know, ability and desires, whatever. So I think that's sometimes when I can get stuck, when I can't find a way to fix that. So then I don't know what I do. I go on Pinterest again, I guess. Just look for ideas to steal from other places. But that's one. And then another possible place where I get stuck is if I have a good idea of what a piece will be and I just can't get it right. And I try to force myself to sort of make the art that I have in my head. Because usually I do a lot of design work and illustration work just mentally for a long time before I even go to the computer. I just lay out the pages in my mind, or I compose the piece in my mind, and then I sit down in Photoshop or InDesign. And if I can't get it right, that can be very frustrating. But then the same thing there, I just have to accept, okay, this won't be the piece that I envisioned. It just have to be something else, and I just have to follow along, you know, let the pen lead and just see where it ends up. And accept that, okay, we will not get that awesome image that you had in your mind, but maybe then it will be something else that's, you know, even better. So that happens a lot, actually. I think most of my artwork is like that. I have this completely different idea that's so much cooler. I just have to settle for whatever happens. So just if you like my art, just imagine what it could have been if I had any say in it.
That's so real, though. Like, as like, I totally resonate as a like visual artist. Like, when you think about something for so long and you're like, oh, this is gonna look so good, and then you make it and you're like, that's about 60% of what my brain thought it was gonna be.
Like, it would be so much grander and bigger and cooler, and no, but you know, yeah, you learn to love it anyway. Sometimes they're just different, and but that's good, because then it feels like someone else did it, and I can use that as inspiration for my next thing. So you just try to disconnect your hand from your mind and just follow along. It's usually what happens to me.
So another project that you've worked on recently that I maybe want to touch on briefly is you did the visual identity for our friends over at Rascal, some incredible journalists, Lynn, Rowan, and Chase. And I'm interested if this is true, and I'm making a bit of a distillation here, but like, the Rascal project feels like kind of where your old graphic design work and your tabletop work now meet, because it's like you're doing like a client focused like brand identity, but for a tabletop journalism company, because it's not a book is what I'm thinking. Like, that seems like it might be the most similar to what you did like throughout your career.
You're absolutely correct. That's exactly the type of work that I used to do. Which is mainly, maybe that's why I liked it so much, actually, because it was sort of nostalgic in a way. It was like, oh, I'm doing like brand identity again for something.
Right. And how is it different now? Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it's kind of the same. Like, I mean, when you do books and you do games, like, you do a brand identity. I kind of hate that. And it sounds very corporate, but that's what you do anyway for any product that you do, a brand identity. But so I think how it differed now, it's just a cooler project. Just cooler people, pretty much. That's just something that I can really stand behind. I didn't do a lot of projects before that I couldn't get behind. It was good stuff, but this is something that I really truly believe in. I want to support, so it just feels great to be on board in any capacity. It was, just liked it. More work. If you're ever doing a project like this, a new website or a concept or whatever, and want a visual identity, let me know, because I love this. That's what I want to do.
You heard folks. Another email to send to Johan. Not only will he do any book, he'll do any brand identity.
Johan, in 6 months, you're either going to be thanking us or you're going to be cursing us. It's one of the two.
Yeah. No, but that's also similar to Paint the Town Red, because I'm not doing graphic design for that. I'm just doing the general art direction and well, the the design identity, and then I'm not doing the layout work. So it's more like art direction job, I think.
And you did the cover. Very cool cover.
And the cover. And I will do some artworks as well. And I will help out with like art commissions. And we made a big like brief document for artists and that sort of thing. So
I do want to turn a little bit towards Paint the Town Red, because coming up in an upcoming season of our other podcast, My First Dungeon, we're going to be doing an actual play of Paint the Town Red.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So I'd love to get your thoughts on going into that game, like just from the text. And now looking at it, where it's at with the playtest and where it's going to be with the final book, what were the touchstones that you were looking for from a design perspective once you got the text in front of you?
So it was a bit from the text, but also from a lot of talks with Zach. So we met at Gen Con, I think 2 years ago or something, and just started this discussion about this book. And I was fascinated by the whole concept of it, the time element and just the vibe. Like it's so great. And I think this the duality, of course, between being a monster and being a sort of human in disguise, or disguised as a human, that's an important thing. And also, and that was where the blood gutter thing came from, of course. But also just doing, like, playing around with these classical, like, vampire aesthetics, what you call it, elements, like the gothic fonts and the pointy ornaments, and, you know, go all in on that sort of gothic look is something I really wanted to embrace and do. And then, I don't know. I'm not sure if this answers the question, really, but it's just make a book that is kind of classical in layout, but then let the art and the typography, so to speak, and not have the graphic design work take a step back in a way.
In your document that would go out to the artists, were there any clear touchstones of what, yes, this is the project, and maybe even more important, no, this isn't the project?
Yeah, so right now we haven't really finished it, but that's the goal, to do that, to be is and isn't. But we have some like keywords and some, like there's a, see if I get this right, there's a scale, like if your style sort of checks a few boxes, then that's right. And yeah, we have a sort of system in the works for that. It's a way that I've never worked like that before, but I really like that. It's very like you're quantifying it in a way. Vampires should be this, 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 and this. And if you, you know, check 4 boxes, then that's good. That's in line with what we want.
It is really helpful to have some of those just like very ticked off quantified things, because then when you come up to that point where you get stuck or you don't know what's happening, it's like, hey, I can reference this.
Yeah.
Great. If I don't know what to do, I'll do that.
Yeah, it becomes like a map in a way.
I do think that's something Soul Muppet does really well, having also worked with them. Like they just like the reference docs and the direction is all, it's all very buttoned up. They really run a professional shop.
That's really good. Yeah, they're great. And I feel like I haven't really done that much of that kind of work in role-playing games, because I do most of my art myself. So that's really nice to be a part of that.
Being in like kind of an art direction role for Paint the Town Red, where you are a little more hands-off of the like layout and the illustration, do you find that to be more or less rewarding, or just like different?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing a great job. I just think it's fun to lay out as well. So
sure,
but I think this was a good this was a good decision, because I didn't really have the time to do it anyway, and they already have like great people who can lay out and do the work that I normally do. So I think it's a refreshing change of, you know, work, if that makes sense, you know, to do something of this more overhead role. Paint broad strokes, and like I made a reference document, or like a design style guide in a way, that I delivered to Soul Muppet. And I think that's something that I've been doing a lot lately for different projects as well, like that sort of concept document. And yeah, so try to like present a visual world for a game.
I do really get the different bits of work scratching different itches of like, I just like layout. Like I was joking to Elliot a couple days ago that I do sound design for My First Dungeon, and I was also doing layout for Elliot's next game, Rom-Com Drama Bomb, at the same time. And I was like tired of sound designing. It was like, it was the hard work of the day. So I was like, ooh, let me go do the fun work of layout. It's just sometimes...
No, it's just different.
It's just different.
I mean, yeah, sometimes you want to do this big, big splashy layouts and art for Mirkborg, and then some other day, days I just want to sit down and do. Have you seen Electric State that I did a layout for? And that's very like gridded, very sort of rigid classic design. And I really love that too. It's a whole different thing. And it's just a palette cleanser in a way.
I'm curious when it comes to like looking at the spectrum of games from Paint the Town Red back to Morkborg, like Paint the Town Red uses a system like kind of similar to Orbital Blues from Soul Muppet. It's a very like story forward game design. And like Morkborg is like a little more on the crunchier side of game design. Like OSR, there's a lot of rules and tables and the like. How do mechanics change how you approach visually, or is there a strong relationship between mechanics and visuals?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's different content you have to present and package. And so for Paint the Town Red, for example, there's a lot of tables, I feel, with prompts and inspiration. I mean, it's the same for Morkborg as well, but it's I don't know how to describe it. It's just the type of game that I think Paint the Town Red is, and also Into the Odd, weirdly, even though that's also like a OSR game, but it sort of lends itself into looking more like a traditional sort of novel look in the book for some reason. I don't know why, I just feel that way. But then like Morkborg and some other more like dungeon crawly games, they can have a little bit more bits and pieces thrown around, kind of like dungeon rooms in a way.
Yeah.
Whilst the other is more like a linear, like a story, not linear, but like a, I don't know. That, but there's some sort of distinction. There's a difference between them in how you present them, and also like the importance of all the different tables, maybe, because in Morkborg there's a lot of tables, but most of them are optional, and most of them are like, oh, if you want to have, I don't know, if you loot the body, here's a table for that. You don't need that table really, but just in case you'll need inspiration. So you don't have to lay that out and present that equally sort of important as the rest. But in other games, maybe they're more like evenly important somehow because they're part of a process or a procedure for play. So yeah, there's some different, I haven't really thought of this that much. That's interesting. But there are surely different requirements and different problems that need solving.
I love what you said about like a dungeon crawler, like it's almost like the pages are the rooms and stuff, thinking about it like space. That's fun.
And you can skip some rooms and you can skip some rules and so on.
Man, this conversation has been great for me because yesterday I turned in the latest draft of a game to Elliot and we're like sending off to the printers to get proofs. And now nice. I'm just looking back in my head of like, ooh, I could do that differently. Ooh, I could do okay. I got ideas.
Sorry.
For things.
Is no, that it's great? Good. We just it's ordered good. Proofs. I don't know if we.
Ordered proofs, so it's good. But
No. That's the thing. You can always change the up to the point where the big, you know, the big numbers are printed. You can always.
Yeah, we're in the last stage where we can change.
Yeah. Oh, you should. Yeah, I always do that. I always send the emails to like printers. Oh, hang on, just want to change one thing. Oh, I want to change one thing.
Wait, real quick.
I'm the worst at ordering print stuff because just the small details. I really, like, remember. Oh, this little line here, hairline doesn't go all the way down to the baseline. It should be one pixel more. Like, who gives a shit? But I do.
I mean, we say it a lot in this podcast about various different art forms, whether it be layout or design or podcasting or performance. Like those little details, when someone takes the time, those are the people who are most successful. Like, that makes all the difference.
I guess so, yeah. Devil's in the details. But I truly, I think it means you care for it a lot and you have a lot of, you put thoughts in it. You just, you want every little detail to be perfect. And that's the thing, again, you have to accept not every detail will be perfect. And you will fuck up. There will be mistakes. In every single printed book, there will be mistakes.
I have a friend who says something to me sometimes when I, like, make a print or something and I'm like, there's this, I got this small like piece of dust on here and I can't get it off. And it's like, is it something you'll notice or is it something everyone will notice? And I'm like, it's something I'll notice. And it's like, all right, then it's good enough to go. It's like, okay.
But the thing is also, I mean, you have to like it in the end. You have to be like, you are your most important target audience.
100%.
In a way, but
100%.
But that's always when I get books from the printer. And I know that there will be mistakes, but still, when I see them, I fucking hate that book. And I can't look at it for a week. And then I'll sort of crawl back to it eventually and come around. But it's always a struggle.
I think the more we talk to people and the more I do, the deeper you get into any art form, I think the more I realize that people can't necessarily, like, I don't think anyone else can see perfection. Like, they're never going to see the details, but they can feel the care. Like, that comes through, and that's the thing that matters.
So, Johan, kind of working our way towards a close, I feel like one of the things that's so important for artists and game designers and actual play producers, a lot of the people we talk about, is, like, knowing and being inspired by the work around you and, like, learning from it and stuff like that. And I'm curious, like, when you're not doing the work of layout, art direction, illustration, what are you, like, playing, reading, watching, like, etc. to be inspired by?
I buy a lot of role-playing game books. I don't read them. I flip through them a lot. And I listen to a lot of music. I think music is a very big, important inspiration source for me, because it sort of bleeds through into the work I do a lot. So I think musically, and, like, I look at the sort of visual representation of the music, the covers and the packaging and everything. But, and then, I don't know. I work so much, so I barely have the time to consume things, I feel. I
can't remember. Real.
It is what it is. Like, I rarely play games. I play, like, once a week now. That's very often for me, though, but role-playing games. But then, I don't know. I sit and flip through things and I browse. Like, I'm a huge Pinterest nerd, so I just go on there and just browse for hours and collect and build my old mood boards and stuff. So that's what I do, mostly. But that's work as well, so I can't. That's cheating, I guess.
But again, it's the fun work. It's the work you do when you don't want to work.
Exactly.
that's the biggest key to success. Find the work you want to do when you don't want to do the real work.
Exactly, and that becomes work in a way, and that will help you in your real work.
Yeah. What's the game you're playing once a week right now?
Oh, it's D&D actually.
Nice.
Yeah, fifth edition, baby. I was invited by a friend of mine who I'd never played with before, and, like, asked me if I wanted to join their game, and I was like, yeah, sure. I haven't got a game group, so I'll join. I'll play whatever you want to play. And they play Dungeons and Dragons, and so I do. It's fun.
Yeah, that's also so real. It's like, if you don't have a regular game group, as soon as someone asks you, it's like, yeah, I'll play whatever.
Hell yeah,
I will play whatever.
Anything. Whatever you play, I'm in. Let's do it. So, yeah, beggars can't be choosers. It's a good group. Good fun. So, I'm not a huge, like, Wizards of the Coast stan, I can't say, but
who is
after this? It's a game. It's fun. I'll run something else for them eventually.
You'll get them. Slip Morkborg on the table one day.
I'm just going to run one simple game. It's kind of like D&D. You'll never notice any difference.
You heard it here first. Morkborg is basically D&D.
Basically D&D, yeah, with smaller numbers and more skulls. That's what it is.
So, Johan, we have one last question that we like to ask everybody who comes on the show. And we call that question, what are you bringing to the table? Which is just our way of asking, who is a person? What is a game? What's a show, an album, a resource? Anything that you like right now that you think is cool that you'd want to recommend to the audience? Could be tabletop related or totally unrelated.
This is also work related, but there's a site, a supplier of brushes, tools, and effects called the True Grit Texture Supply that I would recommend. It's very well known, but it's just like, I think I bought something from them yesterday, and, like, everything they do is just golden. So it's, if you make games, if you make art, just check them out.
Seconded.
Yeah, and also a good place, actually, it's for, if you want typefaces, you can go to youworkforthem.com. They have very good stuff.
Hell yeah.
But that's always when I go. I don't go to, like, my fonts or anything. I just go to youworkforthem.com. Superb stuff.
We'll put both those links in the show notes.
Also, talk about something to, like, break you out of a funk is, like, I always find, like, if I'm in, like, a drawing funk and I get a new True Grit pack, I all of a sudden have all these new toys to play with, and then like, I end up drawing something that I never would have expected playing with it. It's great.
No, it's so good. They really elevated my game when I first bought their, like, mega pack or whatever. So I don't use any other brushes, basically, just theirs. So good.
That's a pretty fucking strong recommendation.
No, it is 200%.
We'll put those links in the show notes for you to check out, because you've got some pretty strong recommendations there if you're looking to do any kind of illustration or design. Thank you, Johan Noor, for coming to the table. You want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
Sure. So you can find me on basically any social media place. So My Instagram is artbynor, it's N-O-H-R, and then I am on Twitter, regrettably, and also, if you look for, search for Mark Bohr, you'll find us, I think.
You'll definitely find it. It's the yellow book.
Oh, it's the yellow one.
It's the yellow one.
Yeah. Yellow small angry book. Yeah. Check it out.
And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. Both of those are linked down in our show notes. Please rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what The Table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.